throne on a magnificent island. We're not certain precisely which one, or for that matter, precisely when. In fact, most of what we ought to know about this ancient ruler has been completely forgotten over the years. Nonetheless, the reign of Tolhan has echoed throughout the centuries since in a marvelous and magical way. Because one morning King Tolhan was presented with an unusual gift. It was a small but splendidly crafted shoe. It was a solitary shoe made entirely of gold. Now, what was most remarkable about it was that despite the precious but heavy material from which the shoe was fashioned, it was as light as goose down, so light that it made no noise even when its sole met stone. Now, most monarchs would have been satisfied simply to admire such a present, but Tolhan was not satisfied at all. To the contrary, he was perplexed and confounded by the golden shoe. He grew quickly obsessed with the desire to discover its origin. The gift giver was taken aback. He had merely purchased the shoe from a merchant on the dock and had asked no questions. Then the merchant must be found, Tolhan insisted. And he was. And yet he could only inform the king that he'd bought the shoe on the mainland from one of the cave dwellers on the mainland. The man had told the merchant nothing of the source of the curious object. So all of the king's men put themselves to the task of finding that one cave dweller. And when they succeeded, and when they questioned him regarding the golden shoe, they were told an incredible tale. Now listen carefully. They said that only a short while before, a beautiful young woman, as beautiful as a heavenly being, was seen at a local festival. She was wearing a glorious cloak of kingfisher feathers and golden shoes. But just as everyone had begun to stare at her, she became suddenly self-conscious and frightened, and then hurried away, leaving one of her golden shoes behind, the same shoe that had come into the possession of King Tolhan. Let me hesitate just for a moment with a reminder now that such an ancient story, however specifically traceable, is in the strictest historical sense unverifiable. And yet, if part of it or even none of it is true, its discovery nonetheless ends an age-old quest for the true origin of a more familiar story, told throughout the centuries in some 700 different versions. For you see, when King Tolhan was told of the country festival and of the mysterious young woman who left the golden shoe behind, he searched the kingdom until he found her, clothed in rags, hidden away by a sinister stepmother and her own daughter. For the beautiful young girl, Yitzien, the beautiful young girl having disguised herself, she claimed, in garments acquired through a wish, had attended the festival and fled, fearing recognition. But now, hers, that young girl's, was the only foot in all the land that would fit the golden slipper, and she and the king were married and lived happily ever after. Of course, you recognize the story, but you've heard it here told as it was told for the first time. Or perhaps as it really happened. But you remember it by the solitary enchanting name Cinderella. And now you know the rest of the story.
Protecting what matters on The Right Choice, AM 1230, KPRL 99.3 FM with Barry Fisher. Advice and information on protecting what matters most in today's world. Brought to you by Adler Belmont Insurance Brokers and their new associate, Heather Bordan, serving the commercial insurance needs of businesses on the Central Coast.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. PWM is the broadcast that helps you become better shoppers and buyers of services and products that protect various aspects of your life, health, and property. We also explore current events, our history, community, institutions, and local treasures that are notable and worth preserving. This hour's guest is Edward Ring, Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. He's going to be talking about a positive vision of taking back California and the current state of play in California's energy and water economies and Trump and the fate of Western civilization. Edward, welcome back to Protecting What Matters.
Well, thank you, Barry. That's quite an expansive lineup of topics we've got there.
There you go. And folks, you can call in with questions or comments at 805-238-5775, 238-KPRL. So Edward, just to remind our listeners, you actually were one of the founders of the California Policy Center, weren't you?
Yeah, there were three of us. Gentlemen down in Orange County that both have been president and chairman of the Orange County Lincoln Club, Mark Bucher and Bob Lowen. I was introduced to them in 2010. We worked on a ballot initiative, and that was roundly defeated because the opposition spent about $120 million, and we were only able to raise $20. Mm. That would have done something about involuntary contributions of dues to political campaigns by members of public sector unions. The Janus case in 2016 at the U.S. Supreme Court resolved that in our favor about 4 years later. But after we got beat in 2012, we thought among ourselves that it might make sense to have some kind of educational nonprofit that could work on some of these policy issues and just try to get the word out on a lot of these issues of what is truly in the best interests of Californians. So that was in 2013, and been involved with the organization ever since. It's really grown a lot. It's becoming a real force in California policy environment.
Well, and actually, what I was going to say to the audience, if you're listening and you have a computer nearby, you should go right now to the California Policy Center website, because it's really a treatise that you wrote on taking back California, and we're going to get to that in a second. I just also want to mention to the audience that you're everywhere writing. I mean, you write for the Center for American Greatness. You contribute to the California Globe, LA Times, Wall Street Journal, and The Economist, and you also write books. So you are one busy guy with all the work and research and writing that you're doing. So let's jump right into this. And again, I encourage people to go look at Edward's Taking Back California on the California Policy Center website. We're going to unpack this. That must have been about a 10,000 word essay, wouldn't you say, Edward? The whole thing combined?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. It's divided into pieces, though, so it's digestible segments.
Yes, it is, and it's really a very positive, forward-looking playbook for conservatives on how to gain back political influence in California. And you identify the three big issues that we need to focus on: is education, crime, and cost of living in California. So why don't you give us the high level on that, and then we'll move on to the next internal topic in there.
Well, sure. You know, California, if we can win here, we can win anywhere in the country. And the introductory sections of this piece talk about our target voters. And I think the first thing you have to realize is just don't even bother trying to convert progressive liberals. A lot of them are living in homes they inherited, so they have minimal property tax. And they don't have mortgages, and they don't feel the consequences of California's policies that are making things so difficult for everybody else. You know, and everybody else in California, if you want to, you know, it can be simplistic, but it's simply true. If you look at K-12 public school enrollment right now, you'll realize we're just one generation away from, you know, the white portion of the electorate, the so-called whites, which are about two-thirds, maybe, it's not really much more than that. They're about two-thirds liberal Democrats. They're only going to be 20% of the population. It's going to be about 60% Latino, which, you know, if you think about the origins of Latino culture, it's pretty similar. It's a European culture. They're by and large Christian. I think we've tried to appeal in many respects too much to their social issues, even though we share the same social values with conservatives. But where we really have an opportunity is on the economic side. California's population is going to be about 15% Asian and about 5% Black and about 20% white. It's going to be mostly Latino. But these are voters that are being just destroyed. They have no upward mobility because, not because of discrimination, which is the answer that the liberals always come up with, but because we have rigged our economy. Our economy is broken. People don't have opportunities for upward mobility anymore in California. The average price of a house is, what, $850,000? It's simply impossible to get ahead in California today. The business environment is terrible, and it's the worst for small businesses. These are the kinds of issues that you can win with. The way to reach out to California's electorate is to ignore everything that the progressive white liberals have to say. It's white liberals that are driving all of this racialist policies, all of the gender politics, all of the social issues, all of the quasi-Marxism, all of the extreme environmentalism. It's all coming from this minority, this dwindling minority of white liberals. So forget about them and talk to everybody else and explain how we can solve all of these problems. You know, we focus too much on trying to expose the corruption. We try to expose the fallacy in all of the issues, why they're wrong, why it's hurting us. But what we need to focus on is what the solutions are, because the solutions are out there. There are solutions to fixing our cost of living. There are solutions to making our system of public, to rescue public education in California. And there are solutions to our problems with crime. And that's where we should be focused. And the worst thing we can do is wait. A lot of people in the conservative movement think, oh, we've got to find somebody who's, you know, a Latino to talk to the Latino voters. We've got to find an Asian to talk to the Asian voters. This is ridiculous. If you can have a Latino speaker speaking to a crowd of an audience of Latinos, and they can be reading from a script, and it can be just, you know, eye-watering, boring, everybody's looking at their phones, nobody's listening. Or you can have somebody, and it doesn't matter what color they are, who's speaking with sincerity and conviction and authenticity and passion and is just mesmerizing the audience. And it's not going to matter who they are. If you're talking to people and you're telling the truth and you're offering hope and you're putting together practical arguments that make compelling sense, people are going to listen to you, and they're not going to care what you are. One of the biggest mistakes we can make is thinking we don't have the right or the ability or the credibility to speak to audiences of people who don't look like us. That's ridiculous. The only people who look like us that we haven't convinced yet are the white liberals, and they're hopeless. Progressive white liberals are hopeless. Get out there. Doesn't matter if you're pale. You know, this horrible... I know I'm starting to get a little bit of field here, but I've heard the leadership of the California Republican Party talk this way. Oh, we were too pale, stale, and male. Have you ever heard that phrase?
Yes.
It's an obscene phrase. It doesn't matter. Get out there. Go into those other communities and talk to those people. Tell them the truth. Give them solutions. And they'll listen to one of us. You know, I'm presuming, Barry, that you're also pale, stale, and male like I am. They will listen to us well before they're going to listen to somebody who just happens to look like them if we've got a message that's a compelling message and somebody else does not. So that's what matters. What matters is what you have to say, not who you are.
So you talk about the kind of candidates we have to have, and also the fact that we have to have something like 20,000, I think you said 20,000 races in the state of California at all levels of politics. And you talk about how important that is to have attractive candidates that can do that, correct?
I do. And you know, it's not generally known just how many elected positions there are in the state. In fact, nobody knows exactly how many, but informed estimates put that at about 20,000 elected offices mm-hmm. in the state. So you got to be out there. What's happening today is public sector unions, of course, dominate the public sector. And so they're always able to find a candidate because they simply go to the workforce and they find a shop steward and they say, we need you to get on the water commission, or we need you to get on the fire commission, or whatever it is, because there's all of these local governing agencies. It's not just city council and county board of supervisors and school boards. It's all of these agencies, all of these special districts. So they have candidates and they have money. And it's harder for us because we're always volunteering and we don't have this statewide network like the public sector unions do that just reaches in with its tentacles to every single elected position. But if you go in there and you're a good candidate, you'll win because the people they're picking are just placeholders a lot of the time because there's nobody else competing with them.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's talk about fixing education. You talk a lot about charter schools, education, savings accounts, teacher tenure, teacher performance. Why don't you hold forth on that? Because I think, you know, we've kind of lost our a generation or more of children in this state through bad education.
Yeah, there's about five ways that, you know, I mean, this is subjective. You can divide things into any number of categories, but I picked five. First of all, yeah, let's make it easier to have charter schools. Charter schools are laboratories. Some of them don't work. I think most of them do. And if you make it so that charter schools can be approved not only by the State Board of Education or the County Boards of Education or school district boards, make it so any private or public accredited university can approve charter schools. Make it so city councils can approve them. So that if you just get one of those governing bodies to have a majority of reform-minded education advocates, you can get more charter schools approved. There's caps on how many charter schools we can have in California. All of this is because of the public sector teachers union that they've declared war on. They view charter schools as a threat. So you have to overcome that by taking away some of these rules that they've put in place. Take away the caps on how many charter schools you can have in any given school district or in the state. And then support innovative types of charter schools, like virtual charter schools. Make it easier for charter schools to renew their applications. And stop allowing renewal applications to be denied on financial grounds. They claim that charter schools take money away from public schools, and this is simply false. A lot of the overhead that is part of the cost structure for public schools is that they still get all of that money. And the charter schools only get the money on the per pupil basis. So, you can look into that. We could spend all day talking about public school finance and why charter schools don't take money out of the public school system in a way that ought to hurt the public school system. But the fact is that has to be debunked, and that cannot be a basis to deny charter school applications. So charter schools are and we have to be the aggressive ones on this, because the California Charter Schools Association, you know, they're in a position of great responsibility. So they have to fight for incremental change. They can't go out there and try to overturn the whole apple cart the way we can, because there's consequences to that sort of, that's a very impetuous thing to do. And if you're responsible for, a trade organization that's trying to help the industry, you have to be more measured in the things you do. It's up to the activists to try to do more and to try to make fundamental change.
And what are these education savings accounts? I've never heard of those.
You know, that's taking off in a lot of states around the country, and it's, I guess the easiest way to understand education savings accounts is that they're the same as vouchers functionally, but they work slightly differently in terms of how you actually operate the system if you use education savings accounts. But the way it works is if you have a ESA, or education savings account program in your state, what you do is come up with an amount of money that would correspond to how much public school districts get for each pupil, because they are reimbursed by the state based on attendance. So you figure out how much it costs and how much a school district will collect per student, which in California, depending on the accounting, I mean, are we going to include the state's allocation to bail out CalSTRS or not, you know, because that throws another $2 or $3 billion on the pile. But it's at least $15,000 per pupil that is being spent by the state. If you use the more inclusive definition, it actually pops up a little north of $20,000 per pupil. What you do is you say, okay, we're going to set up a third-party administered account, like an escrow account, and parents who opt into the system will get that money and be required to spend it at a private school to educate their child in that alternative private school. And the private school gets the money just as if they were a public school getting state funds. And by virtue of that system, you give parents the ability to choose whether they want to go to a charter school, a parochial school, a public school, or a private school. And that's the same thing as school vouchers. It's just a little bit more elaborate, and it's a very interesting idea. Yeah. I think that it could completely transform education in California because it would make it more competitive. You know, as it is, parents are just dying to get their kids into charter schools. Every charter school that has any kind of decent reputation is always oversubscribed. So there's all kinds of demands for this. So we need to make, that's a fundamental change if that was ever going to happen. And it's, you know, and it's something that could happen in phases. You know, you could start in low-income school districts, for example. Who's going to argue with that? And give the public schools competition. The only people that are opposed to something like this are the teachers' unions.
Yep,
because they have a monopoly in California today.
So in the last couple of minutes we have left in this segment, let's talk about fighting crime. We had our district attorney, Dan Dow, on the show last week, and of course he's all behind the new Prop 36. And then touch on, so you had some important things to say about that, homelessness and incarceration and so on and so forth. So let me let you hold forth on that for a minute or two.
All right, Barry, how much time have we got left?
You've probably got about 2 minutes. So we can continue. You can continue. We can continue it on the other side of the break, though. So why don't you start now, and then we'll roll into... the break has just hit us. So you know what? We will just start with crime on the other side of the break. So, Edward, I'm going to put you on hold. And, folks, we'll be right back in about 2 minutes. So stand by.
Ace Auto Care in Atascadero, the best price and service on brakes, tires, smog checks, oil changes, and more. Ace Auto Care, all your vehicle needs, everything you want.
Fox News, I'm Tom Graham. The Israeli military says it launched an attack in the Lebanese capital of Beirut, targeting the Hezbollah commander. Fox's Trey Yinks.
They targeted the Hezbollah stronghold on the southern part of the city. But let me tell you a little bit about Shukar. He is a man who actually has a $5 million bounty on his head from the U.S. State Department for his role in the 1983 U.S. Marines barracks bombing in Beirut.
Israel blames Hezbollah for the recent attack, killing 12 children. Protests erupting in Venezuela. And they're speaking out after authorities claimed a re-election victory for President Nicolas Maduro, but opposition candidate Edmundo Gonzalez claims he has proof he won the nation's recent election over the weekend. America is listening to Fox News.
Garage door jamming? Time to call Hammond.
Hammond Overhead Door Company, serving the Central Coast for over 50 years with all your garage door needs, residential or commercial. Hammond has the right door system for any application. As a local, family-owned company, Hammond Overhead Door Company is committed to providing the superior products you want and the personal service you deserve. Call 238-0524 or go to HammondOverheadDoor.com.
Garage door jamming? Time to call Hammond.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Edward Ring, Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. Call in with questions or comments, 805-238-5775-238-KPRL. So, Edward, we were going to switch gears and talk about crime. So I'm going to let you hold forth on this one.
Okay, thanks. Barry, these are big topics. I mean, we didn't get to cover, there are a lot of ways to rescue the public schools, make it easier to fire bad teachers. Don't lay off the new brilliant teachers. You have to lay off the non-performing teachers if there is a layoff. Make it longer tenure, longer period of time before a teacher gets tenure. Bring back standard aptitude tests. Get rid of restorative justice and start getting the disruptive students out of the schools. You know, these kinds of things could rescue public education, so that's part of the solution as well. And look at all these innovative, like, classical education techniques, which really works, and look that up, because that stuff's fantastic. And I just couldn't ignore that last piece of that, but let's talk about crime, fighting crime. Now, you know, everybody in California understands, I think, by now what happened. We were sold, the worst thing of all was we were sold Prop 47 back in 2014, and it was misleading, which they do this, the attorney generals in California, the partisan attorney generals do this all the time. They put in misleading ballot titles. We could go through today's initiatives that are going to be on the ballot in November, misleading ballot titles. It was something like the Safe Streets Act. You know, yes. It was called something horrendously misleading.
I think Kamala Harris came up with that title personally.
It was our, revered native daughter presidential candidate who did it. And it's a disaster. It downgraded property and drug crimes. And basically the police call their... A lot of their work, they call it catch and release. They can't hold these criminals, and so there's no deterrence, and we're all familiar with what's been happening. So, how to solve this? First of all, there's a very good ballot initiative right now. Is it 36?
Yes,
that's the one going
yes.
to repeal Prop 47. It's going to repeal all of the bad parts of Prop 47. I think Kevin Kiley had a lot to do with that, the congressman, former state assembly member. And that's got to pass. That's going to have a decisive impact. A couple of other things have given us hope. The homeless crisis, it got so much worse, partly because of Prop 47, which means you can't really manage the disruptive behavior of people out on the streets. They can get high, they can steal, and they just stay on the streets. They don't get taken off the streets. The other thing, though, was a handful of Ninth Circuit Court rulings that made it impossible to, you couldn't remove people, you couldn't arrest people for vagrancy unless you had shelter for them. And then the ACLU came in and defined shelter in ways in the courts that made it so you couldn't just bring them to traditional congregate shelters like we used to have, where they, they'd get a warehouse and they'd fill it up with cots and bunk beds, and they'd have a kitchen and they'd have a small clinic and they'd, have washrooms, and that worked. Well, that court decision was overturned a month ago in the Martin versus Boise case. Was appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was overturned, and cities now have the right to arrest people for vagrancy as long as they bring them to any reasonable kind of shelter. What we've had in California is what we've dubbed the homeless industrial complex, because the shelter, the supposed permanent supportive housing that was required, was billions, tens of billions of dollars, was being allocated, taxpayers' money, to politically collected, politically connected developers that were building apartments for like $800,000 a piece. And I'm not making those numbers up. I mean, that's the amount. And then they came up with like innovative tiny homes that are only $300,000 a piece. You can buy one of these things in the parking lot at Home Depot. You can buy a tiny home for $4,000. But by the time it went through all of the layers, all the people that are taking their cut out of these taxpayer-funded allocations, they're still spending $300,000 to put one person, to get a roof over the head, to one person. So that was completely impractical. That has changed. The environment has changed. So now cities that aren't run by progressives, that are run by practical elected officials, can go back to congregate shelters. They can get these folks off the streets. They can put them in there. They can hold them accountable if Prop 36 passes. for their behavior so that they can require sobriety in these shelters, that's going to be a huge deterrent right there. There's a lot of people who are tragically disadvantaged, misfortunes hit them, things that are out of their control, they end up on the street, and we should never forget that. But there's a lot of people on the street that are there because they can smoke methamphetamine and they can steal, you know, up to, what, $950 a day worth of stuff, and they'll still, you know, sleep on Venice Beach in the best weather in the world, and social workers will come out and feed them. That's the reality in California today. So while we have to always remember that there are people out there involuntarily, we have to also be realistic and understand that if we had reasonable deterrence, which we don't have today, a lot of the homeless problem and a lot of the crime associated with it would go away. It would just go away overnight. The other big chance we've got is the worst district attorney in the country, maybe not, because there's a lot of terrible progressive district attorneys, but George Gascon in Los Angeles is in a fight for his political life, and if he gets replaced in November, that's going to be, you know, the biggest city on the West Coast is all of a good, the biggest county, excuse me, on the West Coast is going to have a new DA. There's going to be a whole new ball game if that happens. So there's reason to hope that we can get crime under control pretty soon in California.
You also talk about how incarceration or compassionate incarceration is an important aspect of cleaning up our crime.
There's no harm in acknowledging that. You know, most people, I mean, what makes people turn to a life of crime? I mean, sociologists and psychologists and criminologists, you know, they spend their careers evaluating this, so I can't really speak for them. But it's fair to say that if we could change some of the conditions that lead to crime, and this doesn't have to come at the expense of holding criminals accountable. The difference between a progressive and a conservative is we start at accountability. Then we move back to go, okay, how can we, for example, help to rehabilitate people that we have had to incarcerate? What can we do to help them turn their lives around? You know, and even there, you know, compassion often sounds kind of cruel. I mean, the progressives say, let them smoke methamphetamine, let them shoot heroin, you know, let them destroy themselves, and because that's their right, you know, that's their lifestyle, that's who they are, that's compassionate to allow them to do that. No, it's not. That's horrible. Sometimes people need help to get their lives back, to get their, recover their dignity, you know, reenter society. So if you have, and to be fair as well, California's prison system isn't that bad at rehabilitation. They've already got a lot of programs designed to try to rehabilitate people that have turned to lives of crime. So we have to pay attention to that as well. Give them chances to get into programs like.
You okay there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Give them a chance to. To have these kinds of opportunities in life.
Right.
Again.
Okay. Let's shift gears to, you know, your primary focus. And you talk about in the a couple other chapters of Taking Back California, you discuss the abundant water and energy resources of California and how our state policymakers have mismanaged them. And I'm going to let you roll on this one because this is really your wheelhouse.
Okay. And how much time have we got?
You've got about another 10 minutes.
Well, California is a, you know, it's a state that's got some unique challenges because we have a very dry southwest and we have a very wet northeast. I mean, I'm speaking in very general terms. So we've designed what's one of the most remarkable systems of water transfers in the world. You know, we've got the California State Water Project, we've got the federal Central Valley Project. We've got the Los Angeles Aqueduct and the Hetch Hetchy Aqueduct, the Colorado Aqueduct. It's actually called the California Aqueduct, but it brings water from the Colorado River. And all of these things are designed to bring water into you know, what we've got 5 million acres of irrigated farmland in the San Joaquin Valley, the southern part of the Central Valley. We've got 25 million people living in Southern California, mostly in the coastal cities. And these are systems that we have now been neglected. And so the question is, how can we upgrade them? And how can we do that in a way that creates water abundance? Because right now, the response by the California, the California State Board of Water Resources is the State Water Resources Control Board, is rationing. Everything's about rationing. We've got Senate Bill 1157, which is now in the rulemaking phase, which is going to lower household water use to 40 gallons per person per day. Mm. We've got we are going to be imposing rationing on outdoor water use as well, where you have to have a water budget, and the water budget is going to be requiring a water agency bureaucrat to come to the house, to look at the yard, to ask what kind of shrubbery you've got, whether you really need a redwood tree in your yard because, you know, they use a lot of water and they're not native to the area, et cetera, et cetera. Commercial landscapes, commercial buildings are going to have to justify how much water they're going to use for every square foot of outdoor property. This is just around the corner. See, they're in the rulemaking phase right now. At the same time, they're going into the farming community, and they estimate that the San Joaquin Valley could lose 20% of their irrigated farmland. 1 million acres of farmland is going to be taken out of production. So how this is going to all be affecting our economy and our quality of life are questions that we really ought to be asking urgently, because there are ways we can increase our water supply. You know, so to continue, Californians consume approximately 40 million acre feet a year of water. It's about 30 million for the farms. It's 8 or 9 million for cities. And what's happening in California is we've been getting these environmentalist rulings that are requiring more and more of our runoff to be left in the river or to be left in the reservoirs to be reserved and released later in the summer to maintain healthy habitats in the rivers, instead of being diverted south to our farms and to our cities. And what happened, because this began around 2000, if you look at state water project allocations before the year 2000, they got 100% of their contracted water allocations from the state water project into the farms and into the municipal water agencies down south every year, with one exception. Since 2000, there's only been 7 years when they got their full allocation. Most of the time, they're only getting 50 or 60%. And so what happened in response was that the cities started doing reasonable conservation measures. So our per capita water use in our cities has already gone down a great deal, and we've done a very good job at conservation. The farmers went to drip irrigation and started pumping groundwater. But when they pumped the groundwater, we now have all of these depleted aquifers, and there's not enough groundwater left. So it's a perfect storm, because they've lost their allocations from the rivers at the same time as the groundwater is depleted. So now either they take all of this farmland out of cultivation, or they start getting more water from the rivers. And the way to do that, and the way to avoid urban water rationing, is to construct new water infrastructure to safely divert more water. And there's all kinds of solutions to that.
Edward, we have a caller. What's your question for Edward?
I have two questions, Barry. Thank you, Edward, for being on today. First question, do you think that all these things are done on purpose to take away the priority water rights to the water holders so that they can change who has the highest priority by what was done in California? That's my first question. And my next question is, we'll use the Tulare Lake Basin. You used to have 5 rivers that flowed into what was the Tulare Lake that the Tachi Indians were around there. They took those diversions and rediverted those rivers to where they depleted the recharge of those basins. And what do you feel about that?
Well, that's Tulare Lake is down in Kern County and King County down that way. I'm not familiar with five rivers getting diverted. I know that a lot of that water that was diverted went to agriculture, went to cotton, it went to a lot of the almond farms. So I'm not sure I can answer that question to your satisfaction. I'd have to learn more about exactly what streams or rivers were diverted. I mean, in general, you want to be able to, and I think what they're trying to do now is when you have flooding, which we had a tremendous amount of flooding, not this winter, but the winter before, even down in the King River, the San Joaquin River, they were way over their banks. And they didn't have a real good process to figure out who could use that floodwater. And I know the Tulare Lake filled up, not this past winter, but the winter before. And what we want to do is to try to figure out how, when there's high water, we can divert it into either flooding fields when they're in between, you know, their crop rotations anyway. Some of these fields, like grapes, you can flood them and it won't hurt the grapes unless it's very, very prolonged. Or into dedicated percolation basins. And they also have found some examples of there's ancient flumes, because the Central Valley used to be 400 feet lower in elevation, and so the ancient riverbeds are areas where you, if you find them, you can fast charge aquifers. So you don't have to have standing water, you know, filling up half the valley because you want to keep the flood water. That's a very very interesting solution. What was your first question?
It was about the priority rights of the pre-1914 and other ranchers and farmers that helped build all the systems, that they're trying to put curtailments on them because they've diverted the water to other communities. And this ties into the first question. It was like, you created communities that were tied into farming. Now you want to fallow, and why would those communities exist if they no longer have jobs in the farming community? But going back to the prior thing is, why are they trying to take over the priority rights of other people? And I think it's because they don't like it that they have the priority right.
Great. Yeah, when you talk about water rights, you know, my general preference, I think, is it's so complicated and it's developed over so many decades that we probably shouldn't tamper with water rights and the layers of seniority that we've established, and instead allow people that have senior water rights to trade their water without losing their water rights. I think that's a much more realistic solution. I don't think we should try to take away or alter the water rights that have developed over the last, you know, almost 200 years.
Greg, thanks for your call. So we got about a minute left, Edward, and we've got, as usual, I have more topics here to discuss with you than we have time, so hopefully we'll get you back. Is there anything else on the waterfront that you wanted to mention? You talk a lot about desalinization, what an opportunity that is for us, you know, the wastewater reclamation. These are all big things that could be helpful in California, right?
Yeah, I think we should do it all. I think some of the more cost-effective ways, if we could figure out how to get water out of the Delta in a safe way that doesn't, you know, make the environmentalists apoplectic. And there are some solutions. There are some very interesting. Go to the San Joaquin Valley Blueprint website and look at fish-friendly Delta diversions. You can get millions of acre feet of very cost-effectively that way. I think we should do it all, though, when it comes to water supply projects. We need that diversity in case, you know, you put all your eggs in one basket and that basket gets crushed, you're in a lot of trouble. So I think we really, not only for the cost-effectiveness, but for resilience's yep. sake, we should be developing all types of water supply projects.
All right, well, we're up against a break. I'm going to put you back on hold for a couple minutes, and we'll be back to wrap up the show with Edward Ring.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL is brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel, 238-3080.
I'm Jerry Willis, and this is the Fox Business Report.
Microsoft and chip giant AMD will report their fourth quarter earnings today. Other companies reporting quarterly results include Starbucks, Live Nation, and Pinterest. Prada reporting an increase in revenue in the first half of the year, despite a slowdown in the luxury sales market and a slowdown in China's economy. L'Oreal's earnings increased in the second quarter, driven by skin product sales. Spain is fining Booking.com $447 million over violating competition regulations since 2019. The NASDAQ and the S&P 500 ending Tuesday on a negative note. The NASDAQ finishing down 223 points, the S&P 500 down 27, while the Dow having a good day, ending up 203 points. And that's your Fox Business Report. I'm Laura Cantor, invested in you.
Need life insurance but have diabetes, high blood pressure, or on anxiety meds? If you're a 50-year-old male, even porky or with type 2 diabetes, $1 million of life insurance may only cost you about $200 a month. For affordable term life insurance, call Term Provider and speak with Big Lou at 800-444-2013, 800-444-2013, or visit BigLou.com. Remember, Big Lou's like you. He's on meds too. 800-444-2013.
This Fox Business News update on KPRL brought to you by Stifel, your full-service wealth management firm since 1890. Stifel, located at 1337 Vine Street in Paso Robles. Call 805-238-3080. Stifel,
238-3080. Hi, I'm Wesley Dawes with Stove and Spa Center, and it might be hot now, but winter is just around the corner. So Stove and Spa Center is having a huge 36th anniversary stove, insert, and fireplace sale. We're overstocked, so don't miss out on big savings on quality cast wood and gas stoves by Hearthstone. How would you like being warmer this next winter and save money too? It's possible with a gas or wood stove from Hearthstone. Hearthstone's highly efficient wood and gas stoves come in many styles to fit any home's decor. Save big on Hearthstone stoves and inserts during Stove and Spa Center's big sale. All the products we offer are on our website at stoveandspa.com. Save big on Hearthstone stoves during Stove and Spa Center's 36th anniversary sale going on right now. Don't miss out on all the special offers at Stove and Spa Center. 7485 El Camino Real, Atascadero, between Curbrail and Moore Roads.
Welcome back to Protecting What Matters. We're visiting with Edward Ring, Director of Water and Energy Policy at the California Policy Center. Next week's show will feature Ranelle Baldwin, who's the president of the San Luis Obispo County Lincoln Club. And I have two researchers from the RAND Corporation, Ryan Brown and Todd Helmes, talking about some of their recent research on various different topics. So it should be a great show. You can call in with questions for Edward still at 805-238-5775-238-KPRL. You know, Edward, I'm going to save the energy talk for another time if we can get you back on the show, because you wrote a really terrific article in American Greatness. I believe it was on the 17th, and it's basically called Trump and the Fate of Western Civilization. And you speak to a lot of very important, large, macro things going on politically around the world that Trump represents. And so I'd like you to unpack that article for the audience, because it just couldn't have been more timely.
Sure. The main point of that article was that Trump and MAGA and that movement is much bigger than Trump, and it's bigger than MAGA, the so-called MAGA. It's a populist revolt, kind of a populist uprising that's occurring throughout Western nations, from Australia and New Zealand to throughout Europe and the United States and Canada. And what people are rising up against, they have two common grievances. They don't want their national cultures destroyed, and they don't want their standard of living destroyed. And what's happening is this deliberate attempt to kind of level out every nation in the world. It's bigger than migration. Migration is a big part of it, but it's one thing to import millions of people to your country, but it's quite another to then teach them in the public schools that they live in a discriminatory environment, that they live in a hostile nation. Well, let's not bring them here and tell them that. You know, first of all, it's not true, and secondly, it's very corrosive. You know, it makes everybody, it stokes resentment in everyone, the people that are being told these lies and the people that are being lied about. And the other thing we're doing is we're bringing millions of people into the country at the same time as we have this rampant extreme environmentalism, which prevents us from building anything. So we're not creating room for people to live here, which is one of the reasons that we have shortages of everything, is because we're bringing in millions of people, but we're not allowing developers to do anything in a cost-effective manner because of environmental restrictions. So this is what's behind a lot of these populist movements. You know, and you're seeing that in Europe as well. You know, the restrictions on energy that they're getting in Europe, these kinds of things are making it impossible to develop their economies to accommodate anybody that's coming in. So the message we're giving our immigrants and the building environment that we're creating in our country is making it much, much more of a problem to have mass immigration. And this is, you know, this transcends racism. This has nothing to do with racism. This has to do with, are we going to have a coherent culture, or are we going to divide everybody? And are we going to have a decent standard of living, or are we going to regulate ourselves into poverty?
Well, and I think one of the important things in this article was you discussed the centralization of power and ownership. And I think that's what our caller on water was alluding to. That's what's happening here in our Paso Robles Basin, that certain people are trying to get control of and access to the water that's here. And then you also talk about various types of capitalism that need to be curbed. And I think those two topics are what wrapped up together. Could you touch on that for a minute?
Yeah, I mean, we have, we never want to abandon capitalism, but what we're facing is a very corrupted form of capitalism. If you have a oligarchy, if you have a monopoly oriented economy, if you're centralizing all of your economic power in the hands of, you know, 20 or 30 huge multinational corporations, The irony is this is not functionally very different from communism. In both cases, you're centralizing all of the economic power and all of the political authority in the hands of a small group of people, whether it's a politburo or an oligarchy. In both cases, you're concentrating power. And that's not the kind of capitalism that we fight for. The kind of capitalism that would allow us to have upward mobility and allow us to have a low, affordable cost of living is competitive capitalism. This is not something that's simple. I mean, you can't just be a pure libertarian, because if you do, you'll probably have a drift to what we've got today, which is monopoly capitalism. What you have to do is have government and business. There has to be a tension between the two, and it has to be a balanced tension, and you have to have smart regulations. You can't just deregulate everything. We have way too many regulations in America. I loved Trump's idea, you for every new regulation, you get rid of two old regulations. That's a good rule of thumb. But we do have to break up some of these big monopolies. We do have to preserve competition. And if you have competition, then you have more opportunities, and then you have affordable cost of living. And so, you know, these are complicated questions that don't have simple answers. But that's a good principle to try to apply.
Well, Edward, this has been the fastest hour on radio. You got so much great information, and I hope you'll be kind enough to join us again. Maybe after the election, and you can give us some ideas of where you think we're heading from there. So thank you so much for being on Protecting What Matters today. Folks, visit Ed's website, California Policy Center. He is prolific, and he's terrific. So thank you so much, Edward.
You're welcome.
Folks, we'll talk to you next week. Have a great great rest of the week.
Join us next Tuesday for Protect What Matters the Most with Barry Fisher. Send your questions and show topic ideas to barry@blazinbear.com. AM 1230 KPRL, 99.3 FM, KPRL.com, Paso Robles, Atascadero, Temple.